Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are joining from. Thank you for tuning in to today's informational presentation, SQFI Updates and Risk in Food Packaging. My name's Stone, and I'll be offering technical support to today's speakers. Just a few housekeeping notes. A question we receive often is, will the main presentation be recorded? And the answer is yes. The recordings will be available on our website, YouTube, and Spotify in case you're interested in rewatching later or sharing the presentation with your colleagues. With that, I'll introduce our first speaker, Paul DeMarin, the Senior Vice President of Food Safety here at PJR FSI. Paul joined us about a year ago and has over 35 years of experience in the hospitality, service, and retail agri-food sectors. Paul is a board member of the Ontario Food Protection Association, as well as an advisory council member with the George Washington University School of Business for their Digital Marketing Certificate Program. Prior to PJR FSI, Paul worked for 16 years in the certification industry, with clients in every sector from food safety and supply chain to brand protection and quality. Paul also worked for many years in management systems certification as well. And before that, Paul was a professional chef and consultant for over 20 years. So without further ado, Paul, take it away whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Stone. I appreciate that introduction. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to join us today. As I think many of you know, we've changed our format for our webinars, for all upcoming webinars. And in the past, where we've hosted well over 50 webinars just in the last year, I can't thank all of our speakers enough who have given us their time and expertise to inform and educate everyone who joined us. Our goal was to deliver top content and be looked at as thought leader in the industry. And I think we've accomplished that. So that's why moving forward, we're going to forego the PJR FSI introduction. And so with that, I am very happy to, take the time and introduce you to some colleagues of mine who I've known for many years, Leanne Chuboff and Tammy Van Buren from SQFI. Leanne has well over 30 years of experience in the food service industry, specializing in supply chain food safety and quality assurance. And Leanne's responsible for the technical elements of the SQF program, including the development, maintenance, and technical support of the program. Leanne is very active with many organizations, including GFSI and the AFDO and the International Association for Food Protection. She sits on several committees in an effort to enhance policy and develop programs for the industry to help protect public health. I'd also like to take this time to introduce our second speaker, Tammy Van Buren, also from SQFI. Mm-hmm. Tammy has been manager of compliance for SQFI since November of 2019. Her most recent prior positions were quality manager and SQF practitioner for Treehouse Foods and D&W Finepak. Tammy has almost 30 years of experience in quality control in the automotive and food industries, and she teaches classes in her spare time preparing people to take the ASQ certified classes as quality engineers and technicians. So with that, I am going to now pass it over to Leanne to kick this off. And again, I want to thank you both so much for your time, and we're really looking forward to the presentation. I'll just kind of jump in here and there to ask a few questions and try and keep it interactive. So again, thank you very much. And Leanne, over to you.
Well, thanks, Paul. Thank you very much for inviting us to present to you today on the Food Packaging Code. We've done a number of webinars on the Edition 9 changes, but nothing specific to food packaging. So this is our first ever webinar on food packaging. So I'm excited to share with you the latest in Edition 9. So let's see. Oh, whoa. Okay, just really quick, if you're new to SQF and really all you know about us is how to spell us, I just kind of want to give you an overview. So we are a GFSI benchmarked standard, the food packaging code is, along with our other codes for food manufacturing, storage and distribution, primary for for livestock, primary for produce, primary for aquaculture, all the way to retail, food retail, and food service. We have fundamentals program for those that are just getting started with food safety. And then we have some advanced certification program like our quality code. So our quality code is based off of sound quality principles. And Tammy's going to go into that a little bit at the end of this presentation. But we are benchmarked by GFSI, recognized globally as a accredited certification program. We have 10,000 certificates, 40 different countries, 6 different continents, primarily in North America, US and Canada. Next market is Australia, and then Mexico and Japan. So those are our key sites. You won't find us too much in Europe. We have about a handful of sites in Europe, but in those other regional areas, that's where SQF is primarily located with our certificates. So Edition 9, what we want to talk to you today about is look at the layout and the design. You'll notice we have a new code cover and fancy icons. Go through those changes for Part A, the part of the code that probably many of you have never read, and Part B, those technical changes are those auditable changes. And then we're handing it over to Tammy, and that's when she's going to go into some information for those of you that are either just preparing or for some of you that are still are moving forward to Edition 9. But she's going to go over the data from Edition 8.1, give you those top non-conformances, as well as the scores that we see with food packaging. So she's going to get into more detail of what some of those causes are for those non-conformances in the Edition 8.1 food safety audit. And then she's going to get into the quality code and the changes in the quality code, because the quality code applies to all of our food safety codes, whether it's food packaging, food manufacturing, even storage and distribution, in all the primary sectors as well. She's going to go into some of the key changes within the quality code and the top non-conformances within the quality code as well. And again, if you have questions, feel free to chat them in. I know they're monitoring them. If we can't get to them in this webinar, we'll for sure answer your questions later on through email or whatnot. Okay, some of you might have seen this in our previous Edition 9 webinars, where you're looking just globally at the, or holistically at the changes. 8.1 is on the left, Edition 9 is on the right, and you could see 8.1, we had 5 food safety codes. Within Edition 9, we now have 11 food safety codes. So a big difference, and here's where what we did. We took the primary food safety code from Edition 8.1 that contained animal production, livestock, plant production, and then aquaculture. And we broke that out into 3 different codes. So FSC1 is our livestock production. Primary plant is, you know, some of those other primary codes for indoor ag as well as greenhouses, and then aquaculture. And then for manufacturing, we broke that out even more into other codes as well. Animal product manufacturing, so slaughter all the way to meat processing, and seafood processing, dietary supplements, pet food, animal feed, and then food manufacturing. Storage and distribution and food packaging were broken out within Edition 8, and they remain to be broken out into Edition 8. That was, to me, one of the best moves we made when it came to Edition 8, is to give food packaging and storage and distribution its own code, because there are specific risks associated with food packaging that needed to be addressed within the system elements and not just within Module 13, and it just didn't fit. So within the food packaging code, it's its independent code, focuses on the risks on food packaging. Quality code, as I said, Tammy's going to get into many of the changes in the quality code, but the biggest change, and I don't want to be like, spoil anything for Tammy, but the biggest thing is that any GFSI recognized standard can now use the quality code. So Tammy will get into those specifics. But food retail, food service, and fundamentals, there haven't been any changes to those. So we're at that current edition where it is that those will be updated, probably not till the end of this year, the beginning of 2022. I can't believe I just said 2022, but we're almost a quarter of the way done with, we are a quarter of the way done with this year. So, but as I said, you've noticed a lot of different changes just aesthetically. So we do have new code covers for all the different codes. The colors we tried to keep the same, so orange and red and yellow. I think the primary is the one that changed. It was green and now it's yellow. And then blue for those manufacturing codes, purple for color, for quality code. Just as a reminder, the implementation date for the codes will be May 24th. And I know one of the most frequently asked questions that I get for this is one of the frequent is, will that date change due to COVID? And I always say never, but more than likely not, will not change due to COVID.
Hey, Leanne, just a quick question for you. I know we always get a lot of clients asking when guidance documents will be available. And any thought on that?
That's a great question. That's like the number one question that people ask. So very good. What we are doing for guidance documents are, we're not rewriting the big thick manual for guidance documents, the 180 page document. Instead, we're writing topic specific guidance documents. And our first round will be delivered mid month, like within the next week or so, week or 2 weeks. I'll give ourselves 2 weeks, but it's to be delivered very soon. We just sent off the technical requirements to marketing, and they're formatting and editing it as we speak. And that first round is covering many of the system elements like food safety culture and internal laboratory testing, and what does that mean to all of that. So we have definitely looked at those guidance documents as a place to, as a tool, as an implementation tool, but not recreating that entire book. But we will continue to write guidance documents specific to codes, including food packaging, storage, and distribution. It's just going to be in progress right now. But that first round should be delivered within, I'm going to say, the next 2 weeks or so.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Also, if you noticed when you opened up if you downloaded the code and printed it, or even if you opened it up online, you could see that the inside is changed as well. So we went to a design editor and looked at, you know, what would be easy to read and easy to not just, so the code requirements, you know, the requirements are the requirements, but we felt that if we redesign the internal contents, it's easier for the practitioner to read. It's not as daunting. It's written for adult learners, not academically how we had it before, or even from a regulatory perspective. It seemed very regulatory and academic, institutional-ish. So we redesigned. There's more white space. It's bigger font. It has different colors for the headings, and is easier to be referenced throughout the document itself. And so we are pretty excited because the designer did a really good job and met all of our needs, what we wanted to do. So the packaging code, I just wanted to say too that we didn't develop this in a vacuum. We had working groups for each of our codes that we developed, and this is the list of the participants that participated on our working group for food packaging code, and they were fantastic, really looking at each and every change that we made, provided even the little edits that we had, making sure that the technology or the technical terminology was consistent throughout the code, and just trying to catch all those little things and making it more relevant to food packaging and the risks inherent to food packaging. So many thanks to this technical working group. They were fantastic. It wasn't an easy feat. It really was multiple meetings and feedback, and people took a lot of time. And so I really just wanted to publicly thank everybody that participated on that working group. And to those of you that didn't participate on the working group, maybe you didn't know we had one. If you're interested in, you know, participating in the future, feel free to drop myself or Paul, and he can Perry Johnson, anyone at Perry Johnson, a note, an email, or whatever, and we'll save your name for further working groups. So I always say, you know, if you don't vote, you can't complain. So if you can't participate or follow up on any of the public comments that we receive, then, you know, make sure that you're a part of the process. And it just helps us be better. So even if you don't want to participate in these working groups, then, you know, make sure that when we send something out for public comment that you are part of that process as well. So that would be great. Okay, so let's get into those changes. I'm going to go through the technical changes in Part A and then the technical changes in Part B. So Part A, I always call this the code methodology, and this is really what the site needs to do as it relates to obtaining and maintaining their certificate. That's basically what it is. So it looks at how is the code applied to the audit? How are unannounced audits managed? How is the score managed? What happens when a site's suspended, or what would cause suspension or withdrawal? What is the role of the scope of certification? And how do I define my food sector category? Those typical questions are all addressed within Part A. So oftentimes we ignore Part A when we first start implementing our code requirements because we're so focused on the technical requirements, which is completely valid because your CB, Perry Johnson, needs to know Part A and how it applies to your site. So asking those questions need to go back to Perry Johnson and their interpretation of Part A as well. So, but I want to go over some of the changes because it impacts how you will be audited and how the auditor will evaluate some of the code requirements themselves. So the first change is in scoring. If you're new to SQF, this isn't a big change, but existing sites, you'll know that a major nonconformance, it used to be 10 points. So it was ranked as 10-point deduction from your final score. But in addition 9, we changed that major nonconformity to 5 points. And like I said, Tammy's going to share what those nonconformances are so you can kind of see what was a major and what was a minor. We changed it because we felt that Our objective was to provide a better audit outcome in the report. And we feel that some of the auditors weren't looking at major nonconformances and grouping systemic issues that they see. So we have had in our audit report reviews audits that have been, you know, a 20-point or 20 minor nonconformances or 30 minor nonconformances. And when you look at it, you could probably group 30 nonconformances into 2 major nonconformances. It could be management commitment, it could be to sanitation, or it could be to the.
So this is Tammy. I'll just continue until she gets connected back. So Leanne was talking about the change from scoring from 10 points to 5 for a major. And as she mentioned, you know, a lot of times we do see those nonconformances that could be grouped together into that one major nonconformance. So we're going to be monitoring this change for the coming year and to see, you know, what kind of impact that does have. One of the other changes in Part A was the modification to the requirement for unannounced audits. So it was one unannounced audit in every 3-year audit cycle. And so the audit cycle, you know, allowed for you to have, you know, your first unannounced audit in year 1 of your audit cycle, and then in your second 3-year audit cycle, you would not have your unannounced until year 3, which resulted in about a 5-year difference between unannounced audits. So what this will do is allow one unannounced audit in every 3 years. So it'll be real easy to keep up with. You just look back at the previous 2 years. So one of the other changes for Part A is we removed the requirement for the desk audit for initial certifications. So if you remember, initial certification was always a two-part process. So the first one being the desk audit, where the auditors would just look at your procedures and policies to determine if you were prepared for that on-site audit from a documentation standpoint. And so now that is just going to be, you know, all inclusive into that on-site audit. So no more desk audit for those initial certifications. Now we have opened it up and said, you know, certainly if your CB, like Perry Johnson, wants to offer a pre-assessment in place of that desk audit, that is certainly an option that, you know, our certification bodies may take on if they'd like to. So if that's something you're still interested in lieu of a desk audit, certainly reach out to Perry Johnson or your certification body, and they'll help you out with that. The audit duration table, we have removed that and actually went with the GFSI requirement, which is a minimum number of audit days. So you'll see that as a change. And then the remote audit activities, you know, that is a permanent part of the code now. You know, a lot of people think, oh, the remote audit was just a change coming about as a result of the pandemic. And really what I think is probably the pandemic hurried it up a little bit, but I think really it was kind of on its way in. And so we put that in edition 9. And so you can have up to 50% of your audit done remotely, and then followed by the 50% on site within 30 days. So I think this is a great option, and will, you know, just give an opportunity for the auditor to be focused on certain things during the remote portion, and then really when they're on site to just be able to devote a lot of their time to interviews and observations when they're there, record reviews, things like that. And then what we did for suspended or, when a site gets suspended or fails an audit, we clarified the requirements for that and added that if-then table, and you'll see an example on the slide from that. And so it just makes it more specific to a site if they do go into suspension. So I'm thinking Leanne might be back on now.
Yeah, so I think Leanne's back. Yeah, thanks for jumping in there, Tammy. I do have one comment and one question. Either yourself or Leanne, when we're talking about the desk audit requirement being removed, I just think it's important that we clarify that even though it's not required, that it's a separate activity, still reviewing that information is a requirement of the standard. It's just combined together now in one assessment, right? Like, it's still required that you will, you know, as a part of the audit, look at policies and procedures and work instructions and things like that. That doesn't go away. It's just, it's not a separate activity any longer, right?
That is correct. So your initial on-site certification audit would be all encompassing. So right. It's still the entire code gets audited. So all of the procedures, everything would be done at the on-site, the audit then, rather than as a separate piece. Absolutely. Right.
Okay, good. Yeah. Cause I've had a couple of clients call and say, well, wait a minute, we don't need the desk audit anymore. And it's like, well, yeah, nice try. But yeah.
You're still going to get audited.
And then I guess the other question maybe for Leanne is, I understand how we're doing it, but let's hear your perspective on how CBs should be calculating audit duration without the table.
Okay, thanks for that. That is just the $24,000 question, because what GFSI has put into place is minimum audit time days. So food packaging is 1 day, food manufacturing is 2 day, primary is a half day. So they've calculated minimum audit time that they want the auditor to spend on site. So they're very concerned about how much minimum time is spent at the site. And I'm actually in a ISO working group for 22003 part 2, and we're even looking at audit duration tables and minimum audit duration times as it relates to that. So the concern is the minimum, not so much the maximum. As it relates to determining total audit time, you know, not including starting at one day minimum, you can still refer to that audit duration guide that we had in edition 8.1 if that's going to assist you in how to calculate it. Actually, we got that from an ISO document. So it is in line with what the other standards have as well and what ISO recommends. So you can still use that duration guide. It's just that it's not within the code. There was this perception that the duration guide, that's exactly what the sites that the CVs had to use, and that's exactly the quote. But there's a lot of factors that go into it. It's not just people, square footage, and the complexity of the operation. It's a lot of, you know, how many SKUs do you have, and, you know, do you have stairs, and where are you located, and that, you know, also, and how many different languages is spoken at the site, and is there an added food sector category? So there's a lot of others that go into audit, building audit duration, and that guide that we provided in 8 was just not clear and didn't incorporate many of those other factors. And so the way that we phrase it in edition 9, it's that minimum, here's where you have to start at one day, two day, half day, whatever it might be based off of what food sector category you are. But from that point forward, feel free to refer back to that duration guide table that we had in 8.1. And we'll be revising that once we get further clarification from ISO or further clarification to from GFSI. But yeah, we can provide that as an extra guide, but not included in the code.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry for the internet disruption. I was just talking to myself until I looked down at my phone and Tammy's like, we don't hear you. And I thought, oh my goodness, okay. So sorry about that. I will make sure I keep an eye on the microphone in case hopefully I don't lose you again. I feel like it's the internet provider just giving me a, hey, you still need us kind of a thing. So so let's move on to these technical changes. This is what the auditable changes are for food packaging and specific to food packaging. And I always give a top 9 for edition 9. It's no order. It's not like my favorite code changes or anything like that. These are just based off of some of the key changes that I saw in food packaging, some of the questions that we get around edition 9, and some based off the public comments that we got when we first published the code, the draft codes. So the first one is really, there's just been a huge consolidation of technical requirements, the renumbering of technical requirements, and just restructuring throughout. You know, the chemical storage area has been completely revised. I know we did like in buildings and sites, it's been renumbered, and some of the stuff from maintenance is now grouped together. And, you know, we did try and group a lot of the things together, storage of all of everything, the hand washing sinks, for example, even within module 2 and management responsibility, a lot of that was in 2.12 is in 2.11. So little bit of numbering, a lot of renumbering, but a lot of consolidation. So we consolidated about 25% across the code itself, and a more concise and to the point technical requirements. So the first technical requirement I want to talk about is food safety culture, and that is in 2.1.1. And it's specifically 0.1, 0.2, and a little bit of 0.3. So 0.1 is about the food safety policy, and it does include that food safety culture should have that commitment within the food safety policy. 2.1.2 is specific to food safety culture about the objectives, communication, resources, the practices at the site itself. Staff is informed, staff is encouraged, staff is empowered, basically to address any food safety issues that they see. So that is contained in 2.1.1.2, and the auditor will be looking and interviewing staff. They'll be looking at any type of communications, whether they're posters or huddles or team meetings or anything like that, and interviewing staff also to understand what their role is in for food safety. So the auditor, it's now auditable. Most of this stuff was already in the code itself. It just wasn't labeled as food safety culture. So you all were probably doing food safety culture. It just wasn't auditable, and now it's auditable. So that's really the big change there. Number three is we did identify the need for the substitute practitioner. So in 2114 and 2115 is that there should be a designated practitioner and substitute practitioner that is now in that requirement. So the substitute practitioner has to be identified, and then that substitute practitioner has to have the requirements that are outlined in 2115, be fully employed, hold a position of responsibility, have had taken a HACCP training, etc. So all of that is still now is now included for the substitute practitioner. Number four is we added a requirement in 2.3.2.8. So 2.3.2.8 has it's under specifications for raw material packaging, finished product, and services. And we added a requirement that says specifications for direct food contact packaging shall list the functional characteristics to protect the food product. So any of that food packaging, like shelf, that's the functional characteristics such as shelf life extension, barrier properties, et cetera, that's going to aid in that functional characteristics for direct food contact needs to be included in the specifications. Number five is regarding internal testing and sampling requirements, and that's under 2442. So 2442, actually 244 is it talks about product sampling, inspection, and analysis, but 2442 is now includes internal testing. That was always addressed in module 13, but we put it into 2442. So all of that now means that your internal testing and sampling requirements, it has to follow those requirements that are outlined in an ISO guide 17025. And fun fact, actually, Perry Johnson is the one that should talk about this more, but they do accreditation to internal as well as external laboratories. So if you're looking for more specifics as, you know, what is in 17025, you could always go to Perry Johnson for a little bit more information. But this is one of our guidance documents, is how does the SQF code correlate to 17025? Because what you don't have to do is buy the ISO 17025 standards. What you don't have to do is be accredited to 17025. Those are things you do not have to do, because the SQF code addresses really all of what we need. Those applicable requirements are already in the SQF code: record keeping, the proper methodology for testing, training, management and organizational structure, job descriptions. All of that is already in the code. You just have to make sure that your laboratory and the testing and everything, proficiency testing, it's all in there. It has to be addressed within your internal testing and sampling requirements. And I will also say that the applicable 17025 requirements are only for critical food safety tests. So critical food safety tests that are within your code or within your scope of certification, that is what it's applicable to. Number six is environmental monitoring. And there's just a slight change to environmental monitoring that I think makes a big difference in how it applies to food packaging. So we state that it's a risk assessment for all processes shall be conducted against known or expected concerns to identify if an environmental monitoring program is necessary. So that first statement is really just saying that it's based off a risk assessment to the extent of your environmental monitoring program, and even if one is necessary. So just to reiterate, environmental monitoring is not applicable for food packaging, and oftentimes it's probably not going to be applicable. There are some situations and some instances where environmental monitoring programs are needed. However, it's not a mandatory requirement. But what we are asking you to do is a risk assessment to determine the extent of that environmental monitoring program. Number seven is 2.9.2.1, and that's under training. Under training, we added additional requirements for those individuals that the employed at the site. So for sampling and testing, for staff that does sampling and testing, for staff that does environmental monitoring, and for staff that does any allergen management, food defense, and food fraud. So all that has been added to the training program and what relevant staff needs to be trained within that training program. So take a look at 2921, specifically sub-bullet 6, 7, and 8. Number 8 is in regards to new plates, new requirements for storing and printing plates, cylinders, and print blankets, and that's under storage. So under 13.6 for storage. And the last one is number 9, where we added that under 13.6.3.3 for vehicles or for loading, transport, and unloading practices. So when the vehicles used for transporting food sector packaging from the site shall be secured from tampering using a seal or other acceptable device system agreed upon by the carrier and customer. So that was added to 13.6.3.3. And so those are really the summary. Again, I think number one is just the consolidation, the renumbering, the restructuring, all throughout modules 2 and modules 13.
And Leanne, what tests do you think would fall under the new requirement for internal sampling and testing?
So those critical food safety tests to food packaging. So it could be if environmental monitoring is required, it would be if that's being conducted in-house, that would be one of those critical food safety tests. So if it's for Bacillus cereus or any of those indicator organisms, to me would even be a critical food safety test. If it's a functionality, let's say if it's a functionality for food safety, whether it's a barrier or something like that could be a potential test. But just to clarify, it's only those functions that are critical to food safety. So what I've been instructing sites as a guide is to say, okay, list all the tests you do, and then list to determine, is this a food safety function, is this a quality function, is this a customer function, and then identify what the methodology is, what the proficiency testing would be for that critical food safety test. So first task is to just really identify all those tests you do, and then identify which ones are critical to food safety. And that is what would be applicable. That's what the 17025 requirement is referring to.
Great.
Yeah. So I am going to hand this over to Tammy now, and she is going to talk you through some of those top nonconformances, as well as go over the quality code. Tammy?
Thank you. So let's look at some numbers here. So for 2020, you can see there the number of food safety audits that we conducted. This number is down just a little bit due to the pandemic. Typically, we would see a little bit higher numbers, probably closer to the 8,000, 9,000 range. And then I've broke out food packaging there separately, so you can kind of see where those numbers are. We have about, 8% to 9% of our sites that have some sort of food packaging going on within their site. So they are using the FSC 27 for food packaging. So you've got the quality numbers there. Again, all FSCs, we did a couple thousand quality audits last year, and 91 of those were for the food packaging industry. So, a little bit of a fall off there for those sites that are also utilizing the quality code. So I strongly encourage, if you haven't considered that yet, to absolutely talk to your CB, talk to Perry Johnson about adding on that quality code if you haven't, because yeah, it definitely is there and, you know, goes along with your food safety code with a lot of requirements. So it's not like you're adding on a lot of extra requirements, because a lot of it, you know, already fits in with what you're doing for your food safety. And then you can see fundamentals there. We don't have a lot of fundamental sites, but about a third of them are food packaging. So I thought that was an interesting statistic. Average scores for the food safety audit, and you can see there all of the FSCs in 2020 averaged 94.73, whereas just the food sector category 27, food packaging, had a little bit higher of a score, 95.57 there. And I'm going to give you a breakdown on the next slide. And then just to kind of show you where we're at as far as food sector category 27 and food packaging, largely in the U.S., followed by Canada, Mexico, and Australia, as Leanne mentioned. Those really are our primary markets currently. But you can see that we do have some other areas where we are seeing some food packaging manufacturing going on. So just an interesting breakdown there. Okay, so how did those scores for food safety break down in the food packaging code? So as you can see there, I've divided it up into the different ratings. You can see largely skewed to the excellent scores. And so I think I calculated that out, and about 65% of the audit scores for food packaging ended up in the excellent rating, about 33% in the good. And then we have less than 2% scoring complies. And we actually had zero sites for food packaging that failed their audit last year. So outstanding job to our food packaging sites and you know, the attention that they're paying to their audit requirements.
Hey, Tammy, just a couple of real quick questions. Is there anything about these scores that surprise you? That's the first one. And the second one is, how do you see Addition 9 changes impacting audit scores for this year and potentially next year?
I think it was a little surprising when I broke it out for food packaging, just because I hadn't looked at the data by food sector category specific to food packaging. So, you know, we see all our scores generally skewed in that direction towards the good and the excellent. But the fact that, you know, we saw so few complies and no failures, that was a little surprising to me. But I do have a background a little bit. I spent a couple years in food packaging, and so, you know, it is a little bit of a different atmosphere than an actual food manufacturing site. You know, a lot of differences there. So I just find that, you know, outstanding that you know, the scores are that high, that many 100s, that's a pretty significant number there. And so for Addition 9, how do I think the audit scores are gonna go? You know, I really think that with Addition 9, we might see just a slight dip. And when I say slight, I say maybe, I don't even think it'll be a full percentage point. You know, if these food packaging sites are as prepared for Addition 9 as it appears that they are for Addition 8.1, I think they're going to do great. And, you know, for that food sector category, we may not even see an impact to audit scores. Very exciting, though, to see, you know, a year from now, you know, what those numbers look like. Mm-hmm. So let's break down the nonconformances for food packaging for food safety. And the first one, I've listed all the majors. So not only were the scores skewed to the higher side, but the number of majors that were identified in food sector category 27 was really low. And so you can see here the breakdown. Product traceability was the only requirement that had more than one major assigned to it. And I'm going to dig into these majors and talk to you about how I would kind of classify those and group those. Just to mention, there were also no criticals identified for food packaging as well. Okay, so those majors, when I really looked at them and you know, broke down the reasons for those majors, I grouped them into two categories there. So the first one being the largest, program missing or inadequate to control hazards. And you know, cleaning and sanitation fell under that. Dry and liquid waste disposal fell into that. Storage and handling, they were storing waste product, touching good finished products. So that's where that one came in. Product traceability was the one that had the two majors, and one of them was a repeat finding from a previous audit. So the finding was they weren't tracing or tracking all products that needed or all items that needed to be traced. And so they had a repeat finding. And so it was elevated to a major. And then the other site had multiple mistakes in their traceability records. So, you know, information missing or recorded inaccurately, things like that. And that made that a major. And then we saw one in improved supplier program. Basically, this site didn't have an approved supplier program. They did not have a register of approved suppliers and did not have a program on how they determined if a site, you know, could be in that approved supplier list. Pest prevention was another one. I believe that one was related to an unsecured bait station, as well as multiple issues around harborage points inside and outside of the building. So it was just an accumulation of things, which is kind of what Leanne was saying when she was talking about when we reduced that score on a major from 10 points to 5. So, you know, in this case, the auditor went ahead and assigned that 10 point major, which should have been assigned, looking at the laundry list of things that were wrong with the pest prevention program and the implementation of it. But what we see a lot of times is that auditors will take that laundry list and will write 5 or 6 minors rather than making that jump to that major. So, you know, I'm glad the auditor did, looking at that list of items that, you know, qualified that for a major. I would totally agree with that, that it should be qualified as such. And then management review. So basically they had changed their management review program and they weren't meeting the requirements of the code. They weren't identifying all those things they needed to be covering in their management reviews. And then the other category was direct product contamination from overhead droplets. One of them was assigned to 13.7.2.2 foreign matter contamination, and that was a lubricant droplet, and it was in multiple locations in the plant. So that was overhead contamination, and then the other one was assigned to premises and equipment maintenance, and it was water droplets in multiple locations in the plant, and both of them were over direct product contact surfaces. So I thought the auditors did a great job of, you know, really capturing the major nonconformance for most of those. Now let's look at the minors. So I did a top 13 minors for module 13. And the reason why I did that was when I looked at the top nonconformances, I really saw more nonconformances related to the GMP module or module 13 versus module 2 with the system elements. So, you know, looking at this top 13 for module 13, I've highlighted 6 of them in red there, I've highlighted 8 of those in red. And the reason why I did that is because they're from specifically from 13.2. And so if you think about 13.2 there, that's construction of premises and equipment. And so all those things fall in within that section. And so you can see the top five are specifically from that section. So a lot of emphasis there. And I'll give you just a second to kind of glance through those. Nothing surprising to me jumped out. I am going to dig deeper into those top two on the next two slides and really get down to how those minors were assigned. So the first one there, there were 137 minor nonconformances for dust, insect, and vermin proofing. I could group all 137 of those into four categories. So the first one, and by far the largest, gaps around dock plates and overhead doors. And I cannot tell you how many times I saw the word daylight in those minor nonconformances and the evidence written by the auditor. So the auditor said, I saw daylight, I saw daylight. And then coming back to the causes of that, worn brushes or seals, missing brushes around dock doors and dock plates or seals, and failed to close completely. So just somebody did not properly shut the door all the way. And then the next one was screen usage. So one was a missing screen or a screen not being used for an overhead door, and then screens missing from exterior vents. Then I saw a few where the corners weren't covered. So if you think about when a trailer backs into your dock door and, you know, it's up against your dock pads and you have the dock plate that comes out into the trailer, there's always that corner down at the bottom, left and right, where you see daylight. And so that was not being protected from a potential pest and vermin. During you know, the loading and unloading of trucks. So be mindful of those corners. And then there were just a handful for damaged doors. And so that's what made up really those 137 minors. Having problems finding my, okay. So then number two on the list was cleaning and sanitation. This accounted for 112. And really when I looked at those, I could break those down into a couple. So the cleaning program itself, either not being implemented in all areas, and many, many times it was mentioned the warehouse. Dock plates, battery charging station, racking, things like that. Or the cleaning program wasn't adequate. So, you know, things weren't put away, things were stored on the floor, there was accumulation, dust, debris, wood, trash, webbing, all of that. And then there were some reference to cleaning chemicals. And then the other one was records, just missing data off of them. Or they think it was done, you know, the cleaning was done, but it wasn't recorded, it wasn't signed off on. Or they were cleaning, the frequency was supposed to be daily, but they weren't doing it daily. They were doing it, you know, twice a week, three times a week, something like that. So incomplete records for their cleaning and sanitation.
Tammy, do you anticipate a shift in nonconformances for 2021?
You know, I've been doing a little bit of research lately on those nonconformances when we switched from edition 7.2 to edition 8. And, you know, when Edition 8 came into play, some of those nonconformances that rose to the top had to do with some of those new requirements. So if you think back there, you think, you know, food fraud and some of the new things that came into Edition 8 really rose to the top. So I would anticipate for Edition 9 that we may see some of those new requirements rise to the, you know, the top 10. So think food safety culture, think labeling requirements, you know, some of those big changes, internal labs being another one. So I think we will see a little bit of a shift in the types of nonconformances that make up our top nonconformances for 2021.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And so just quickly, I know we're coming to the end here, so I just want to cover off on the quality code a little bit. We have mentioned that. And so quality code for edition 9, as Leanne mentioned in her slide, sites that hold GFSI or technically equivalent food safety certificates may apply for the quality code. And, you know, we really did this because we heard that there were sites and companies that were certified to other GFSI schemes who were actually taking our quality code and requiring their sites to be compliant to it, even though they couldn't be audited by a certification body and receive a certificate from, you know, an SQF certificate. They were actually requiring their sites to be compliant. So we thought, you know, why not? Why don't we make this a standalone code and open it up to those other technically equivalent food safety certificates? So with that, we had to remove the language that was specific to SQF. And there were a few requirements that were in our food safety code that we just added into the quality code so we could make that quality code truly a standalone code. You know, one of the examples is the accreditation requirements for external labs. So it was in the food safety code. We didn't explicitly spell that out in the quality code. So now we do. Requirements for personnel conducting supplier audits. So there's requirements in the food safety code. We just had to state that in the quality code. So we did that. New for edition 9 quality code, quality culture and label approval. You'll see those in there. We also changed reference to a quality manual. So, you know, I know from an auditing standpoint, a lot of times the auditors come in and one of their first questions is, let me see your manual, whether it's a food safety manual or a quality manual. So what you're, you know, allowed now is a little bit more flexibility. And so the wording is more around not a quality manual, but just having that documentation in place to support your quality program. And then updated terminology. So, you know, I really challenged the working group, as Leanne mentioned working groups before. I had the quality working group working with me to update the quality code. And, you know, the terminology, you know, corporate became company. I really challenged them to make it just obvious that that the quality code is for everybody, regardless of you know, site size or company size. So, you know, we wanted those sites to know that even if they don't technically have a corporate office, they or a corporate entity, they still qualify to be accredited or not accredited, but certified to the quality code. So, so that was a change. And then training register became training records. And so, you know, again, just to give a little bit more flexibility in how sites will implement their quality code.
And Tammy, what do you think is going to be the biggest challenge for not only the sites, but also the auditors for the new code?
Okay, so as far as the sites go, I really think the way that the quality code has been written, the terminology changes, I think it's really going to open them up to more flexibility. And I'm really hoping that that's going to draw in and encourage more sites to seek that quality code certification. As far as the auditors go, wow, I think the biggest change for them is to be able to audit that as a standalone code. Because in the past, typically, I mean, it was an option. You could have your quality audit separate from your food safety. I'm not sure that anybody really ever, you know, had them separate. It was minimal at best. But I think this new option here for other GFSI and technically equivalent food safety programs to be able to be certified to the quality code is going to be a huge change for our auditors because they will truly have to audit that as a standalone code. And so I think that will be the challenge. So,
great.
All right. So I think that is going to take us, to quality top nonconformances. You know, there's not a lot. So just want to cover this off again. This is related here. So we've got two majors, quality, both of them food quality plan. So you can see the causes there, unclear CQP procedure, quality hazards not being identified. And then there were 100 minors. And again, these are food safety food sector category 27 specific for the quality code. And so internal audits was the number one minor, and that was not all elements of the quality code being audited. I will tell you that is the number one internal audit requirement or non-conformance for all food sector categories, not auditing the entire quality code or food safety code for your internal audit. And then product trace, missing lot codes or records, and then customer requirements and no records of review. That's what all five of those minors were for. There were no records of review of customer requirements. And with that, I think we have come to the end of our presentation. And so I think I'm going to hand that back over to Paul.
That's great, Tammy. Thank you very much. And Leanne, I know we're getting tight on our time here. We're actually right at our limit, but I did have two quick questions from the audience that came in. So I just want to quickly address these here. These are a couple of upcoming webinars we have next week. Please join us for that. But the first question was, I'm going to try and read this here. It says, how about the cycle for the different auditors? Is that every 3 years? If that is every 3 years, it will overlap with the unannounced. Is that correct?
I'll take that. This is Leanne. So it's every 3 years. So it would kind of, if your auditor is in sync with your unannounced audit cycle. So kind of all depends. But so auditors are allowed to audit the same site 3 years in a row. After that, they have to step away for at least one audit and then they can come back. But it kind of all depends. If your auditor cycle and your unannounced audit cycle is at the same, then they'll get you, I guess, every 3 years until the CB changes it up. But that might be more of your question, Paul, but that's how
I look at it. No, I can certainly address it, but I thought I'd give you the opportunity to as well. And then the other second part to that was, can you repeat which SQF codes these directly relate to? And it's IE 13.6.3.3. Maybe you can just confirm if that's correct or not.
That's the one regarding using tampering or using a secured seal to prevent tampering on the vehicles. And that's okay. Loading, transport, unloading, 13.6.3.3.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. And then Stone, were there any other questions that came in?
It looks like those were the last questions.
Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, then that's it. Well, I guess at this point, we'll thank Leanne and Tammy very much for their time, everybody that joined us. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll look forward to visiting with you on future topics. And Leanne and Tammy, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
One last question just came in and it says, will the slides be sent out? And the answer is yes. But thank you all very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.